Everybody, these are such great meetings to follow, and thanks for being here tonight. I have recently discovered that I'm very sensitive to anniversaries, and we're coming up on the anniversary of the Dobbs decision, and so I've been pulling out things that I've been working on around abortion, and I'm going to read the first part of a very long essay about that. And it's called How to Survive a Name. It's 2015. I'm idling in a prison parking lot, waiting on a phone call from Planned Parenthood, radio on scan, trying to land a song I can sing along to. The creative writing class I teach each week at the prison begins at 6 p.m. I try to be ready at the metal detectors by 5:15 in case anything goes wrong. There are always things that go wrong. The state of Pennsylvania requires women to go through two screenings in order to receive a medical abortion. My first screening call is at 5 p.m. The nurse explained last week that the call will take 40 minutes, which will theoretically allow me enough time to pass through security and still make it to class on time, as long as this phone call, this circumstance in the parking lot, is the wrong thing tonight. I put my phone on speaker and listen as a doctor reads a script detailing the number of state benefits I will qualify for if I decide to carry the pregnancy to term, which of course means if I decide to have a baby, if I become a mother. It's difficult to concentrate on the long monologue the doctor delivers with rote obligation. Surely she doesn't want to be delivering this monologue. There are three other women also pregnant on the call. At various times, the doctor pauses, and we're all required to give verbal acknowledgement and consent about various statutes and risk factors. We are a trio. I understand. I understand. I understand. I was born in 1981, and my name is Sarah. Sarah was the most popular name of 1980, 81, 82, 83, 84, slipped to number two behind Jessica in 85, but we came back strong in 86, and the rest of the 80s and 90s continued in that manner. Having the most popular name of the generation is an exercise in solidarity. I'm always a plural. Invite the Sarahs. Which one of the Sarahs is on the phone? Is she a member of the Sarah Club? In a graduating high school class of 200 kids, there were 12 Sarahs. My best friend's name is Sarah. My college roommate's name was Sarah. There's a very sweet two-year-old in my life who calls me by my full name, Sarah Shotland, because so many of her mother's friends and aunties are named Sarah. At last count, I had 16 Sarahs saved in my phone. When women named Sarah meet each other, we simply nod our heads. I imagine all the other women on this phone call are also named Sarah, that were Kelly heads springing from a shared body politic. In the parking lot of the prison, I'm wondering, are these other phone Sarahs in their kitchens preparing dinner or after school snacks for their other born children? Are they in the break room at their retail jobs, empty hotel conference rooms, locked in a bathroom with the shower running, trying to hide? I wonder where they live. This is one of the only clinics to get an abortion in the county, so they might be 2 blocks away or 2 hours away. I'm 33 years old, and this is my second abortion. 14 years ago, at 19, I had the first one. I was a sophomore in college with a terrible on-again, off-again boyfriend, a super fun cocaine problem, and a part-time waitressing gig at a fish place where customers were encouraged to throw their peanut shells on the ground. Every night, I would come home covered in peanut shell dust, the smell of which never seemed to wash out of my hair. That abortion seemed obvious, if not easy. It was clear that having a child would be outlandish, reckless. After that abortion, I bought an 8-ball and a bottle of wine and hung out with my girlfriends all night long, blowing rails and gulping cheap Pinot Noir. The next day, I showed up for a shift at the fish shop. By 20, I was using heroin, and at 24, I was checking into a detox center to start the slow process of recovery. But all that was over a decade ago. And here I am in a parking lot, a stone cold sober school teacher with a boring Toyota Corolla and a bronze level Obamacare health plan. I'm not a 19-year-old strung out fish shack wench. If I wanted to have a baby, I could make it work, mostly because of the rock solid group of women in my life. Every external and circumstantial detail of this parking lot is different, and yet here I am making the same second choice. What about the other Sarahs? What fish shacks do they waitress in? What bridges are they building and burning? We're giving up our rights to WIC and Medicaid, they tell us. We are answering a chorus in the affirmative. After each statement, the doctor on the speakerphone declares, "We understand. We understand. We understand." Slowly, we become a chorus. Disenfranchised grief is the therapeutic term for mourning an unacknowledged loss. Maybe it's the death of a mistress, having an estranged parent, the IVF treatment that never works, the adoption that never comes through. Disenfranchised grief could refer to a bankruptcy or gradual hearing loss or retirement from a job you spent 40 years complaining about. Disenfranchised grief also involves stigma and acknowledgement. Children, for example, are generally left out of our communal rights of grief. And so when they experience loss, it often becomes disenfranchised because they have to stay quiet. When someone shoots themselves in the head or drinks themselves into a drowned liver or is sentenced to death by the state, that's all stigmatized, disenfranchised grief. Abortions, too, are a disenfranchised grief. The loss of a decade to heroin, that's a disenfranchised grief. The 15 years I spent working in prisons, each day witnessing the loss of possibility and personhood, the potential that just radiates out of prison, that was all me swimming in disembodied, disenfranchised grief. And one of the challenges therapists grapple with when working with clients who are experiencing this disenfranchised grief is the struggle to explain the meaningfulness of a relationship without having a name that encapsulates its importance. When people deal with grief, they deal not only with loss, but with language. We want a way to name the pain and be acknowledged. We want a way for our love to be recognized. I want to tell the men in my class what's happening in this parking lot. The theme of the class this semester is masculinity, and I'm the only woman in the room. Each week, these men write about their fathers, the things they were taught and the things they should have been taught, the heavenly and earthly fathers, the ways in which they can and cannot perform their own responsibilities as parents, the ways in which culture has encouraged their self-destruction, their community destruction. And in many ways, these men have become idealized versions of the masculinity that teaches us to conquer, destroy, fight, earn. This is why they're here. They've excelled. They are the overachievers in the subject of masculinity. They write about their failures as fathers, and I want to tell them, I'm a failure at even becoming a mother. I'm usually at the metal detector by now. I'm usually being searched and waiting for my administrative escort to ferry me across the prison yard. I definitely don't want to tell my students at the university that I'm having a second abortion in my 30s. I have no desire at all to tell a coworker or a member of my writing group this. I'm obviously not going to bring this up with the 14-year-old middle school students I'm teaching about the Harlem Renaissance this week. In every other place in my life, the boundaries seem so clear and defined. They might even be called healthy. But at the prison, I want to be known and seen vulnerable. I want some kind of unhealthy approval from these men. I want them to let me face them. Do I want to tell them I'm having an abortion because somewhere deep inside, I believe it's a crime? do I want to tell them about this because they're the people in my life who most understand impossible choices? That they have all the wisdom when it comes to choosing between options that are all undesirable, harmful, wrong. They're the people in my life who know the most about consequences and the ways those consequences come to rest in the base of your neck, how to spit them out, how to metabolize or metastasize them, how to keep it moving. Do I want to tell them about my abortion because I want their advice on how to survive my own violence? Of course, I'm not going to tell the men in my class about what's happening in the parking lot. They're not meant to comfort or care for me. And after all, they don't tell me about what happens in their cells. Instead, we meet in the middle space between the parking lot and the cell blocks in the classrooms, where we show each other the weight of our choices in 1,000 different homes. We explain to each other without saying it plain what the choices really were, what the consequences really are. Instead of telling the group of men about what's happening in the parking lot, I'll just hang up the phone with the other Sarahs. I'll move quickly into a new name, Professor Shotland. Before I button her up and put Professor Shotland on, for a quick slip of a second, I feel the slide into a different Sarah. A third, a fourth Sarah. She's 7. She's on the side of the Dallas freeway, standing by a sign as tall as her small body that reads, "Abortion stops a beating heart." Her father, my father, beaming beside her as the trucks honk. She's there in a flash, then gone, Professor Shotland shooing her away, clearing her throat. Thank you.